Yeah, when showing up to the Ones Ready podcast, folks, never say, like, we can talk about whatever you want to talk about. Although Aaron's not here today, so, you know, we could probably stay within the lines and keep it pretty easy. Welcome back, everybody. Our guest today, Chief Master Sergeant Josh Leonard. When was the last time you were on, Josh?
Oh, man, it was about a year and a half ago. Yeah, it's been, because it was, what was it, 23? Yeah, 22. The end of summer of 22 is when I was on, man. So right before I went on the hill.
Yeah. So kind of a lot's happened since then, right?
Oh yeah. Tons of stuff, man.
Well, for everybody listening, go listen to the last episode we did. It was all about, you know, Chief here about to go up on the hill and do political things with political people. I don't know what any of that means. But you're kind of like, you did that, and now you're moving on to something else. So, like, if you don't mind, give everybody the update, you know, like, what happened?
Yeah, man. So based off of the last episode, man, we talked about the fellowship, man, of being a part of the legislative liaison. So, going up, getting an opportunity to go on the Hill. So, January of 23, I got to go on the Hill. I worked in Senator Bozeman's office. And I worked on in his office for a year. So I did his defense and veterans portfolios. And so there's a little bit difference between working on the House side and working on the Senator side, on the Senate side. They call us the bougie side because we get like a bigger team. There's only 100 senators, right? So we get a bigger, he or she gets a bigger staff. So we get to kind of go into our niches, right? And work on the things that we like to work on. On the House side, the smaller teams. And so they got to work on a multitude of things. So, but I got a great opportunity, man, to work on the defense portfolio and the veterans portfolio. So some legislation that on the VA side that we were working on. And then also to on the defense side, I learned a ton about the industrial base and how critical they are to our security, right, to our defense. And so, man, spent a year up there. Worked with some great individuals, Pat and Bradley. Shout out to them, man. They were great teammates, man, and learned a lot from them. And they're still doing great things on the Hill. Bradley went, and now he's on SVAC committee, with Senate Veterans Affairs Committee, right? I have to give those acronyms out there. But
yeah, because I don't know them.
We're like,
like, who? What is that? I don't know. Is that good or bad?
Yeah. Or I don't know. Sounds out. I don't know.
Is that a self-guided missile or how is that?
But yeah, so he's doing big things, man. Pat is killing the game, man. And so, man, it was just, it was a phenomenal experience working on the Hill for a year. And now I transitioned back to the Pentagon, and I work in SAP FML, which is basically the budget side of legislative liaison. So I'm on the strat team where we advise the top eight of the DAF. And then I also specifically have the SIMSAP and SIMSIF portfolio. So anytime they engage Congress from an appropriations perspective, I advise them to make sure that, you know, they're saying and doing the right things to get funding. So
you must have been busy then recently, because weren't they just on, wasn't SIMSAP just on Capitol Hill?
No, great question. Yeah, no, she was. Both SIMSAP and SIMSIF were on the Hill on the House side for the Quality of Life panel. I was not involved in that just because I was just transitioning back from being on the Hill. And then I was going to the chief leadership course, and then I had some leave and stuff like that. And so I didn't get too heavily involved in that. I paid attention. I watched the hearing, but I wasn't involved in that process. So.
Yeah, and for everybody listening, the SIMSAF is the Chief Master Sergeant of the Air Force, right?
Oh, yeah. CSAF
is the
SIMSAF.
And so, like, you're advising the top people in the Air Force on stuff, right? That they're gonna to move forward through, like, the SecDef and all that other stuff back to Congress.
Yeah. So, you know, anytime, you know, the Chief of Staff of the Air Force, Chief Master Sergeant of the Air Force, a Secretary of the Air Force, anytime they engage Congress, right? Like, we got to kind of give them a backstory of what they've already talked about with those particular members. We also got to tell them, like, hey, here's kind of your points that you want to push to them. If you want to get funding in a specific area, here's some highlights of what that particular member is doing in their district, right? So to be helpful to the principal. The principal is the Secretary of the Air Force or whatever, right? As they're talking to that member. So just kind of give them a little bit of guidance of, hey, here's what you previously talked about. Here's what you want to talk about. Here's your main points of what you want to get across to them. And here's their main points of what they want to get across to you. So so it's pretty fun sometimes, to be honest with you. But what I will say is I realized this last year on the Hill, I am not a staffer. I'm not a behind the desk kind of guy. And so I'm like, okay, man, I it was a lot of learning for me and a lot of humility. So
is that what staff generally is there? Is more of cubicle behind the desk admin work, or is it like, I mean, I could see it doing that, or I could see it being part of, okay, I've got to go visit this representative's folks. I got to go, you know, in terms of talking and coordination and going, hey, what are you guys working on? And what are you guys, you know, and hey, we can tit for tat kind of thing.
No, that's awesome. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Right. So it's a lot of staff work. Right. So you're doing a lot of meeting notes for the member. You're doing a lot of hearing preparation for the member. But yes, when you're doing legislation and stuff like that, I need to reach out to, you know, Senator so-and-so staffer to talk about this particular bill that I want to introduce. And we need, you know, to have a bipartisan effort so that we can get this passed. And so, you know, let's go get a coffee or whatever. So yeah, you'll do that a lot of the times too. I would tell you that a lot of getting things done on the Hill is based on relationships. It is a relationship game, right? And, you know, you see a lot of people getting on TV talking about they're introducing this and introducing that. It's one thing to introduce. It's a totally different thing to get things passed, right? And it become law. And it's all a relationship game. And so one of the big things that I learned was how bipartisan things are when you're actually in the mix of things, right? Of really trying to pass legislation. You can't pass legislation, you know, from just a Republican perspective or just from a Democrat perspective. It has to be a bipartisan effort. And so you got to work across the aisle, man. And it was pretty cool to see and to be a part of. So
are you saying there's some performative aspects of being in Congress when you're in front of a camera?
Oh, I mean, yes. Yeah, I mean, there's
everybody
no denying
knows,
it, right? Yeah. There's no denying that.
I want names.
Who's performing?
Exactly.
Who's being real? Yeah.
How about all of them? All of them are performing.
I love it, man.
So when you got to Bozeman's office, like, is it, like, I know you did like some prep work. I just want to go back because I love like when people start a new thing, like the amount of growth that happens. Right. And like nothing works the way that you think it's going to work. And when you show up, you're like, oh, I think I'll be doing this. And then everything changed. But like your first day you showed up, like how prepared were you and how much did you just have to like, just like sit there and like absorb stuff or jump on that wagon and try to hold on for dear life?
Yeah, no, it was a lot of jumping on the wagon and holding on for dear life for sure, man. So I will say that our program, the Air Force's fellowship program, is different from like the Army and from the Marines. Like they have the same fellowship programs, but the way that they prepare their people prior to going to the Hill, I think is a lot better than what the Air Force does, right? I feel like, so we get like a 2-week kind of introductory course prior to going to the Hill, but it's like a fire hose, you know, very basic, like you just, right? And so, and then the Army and the Marines, what they do is they have a master's program. So they get to DC in like April timeframe, and they start their master's program, and that's all they're focused on prior to going to the Hill. And then they'll finish their master's program like their first quarter on the Hill. And so like they have like, I wouldn't say an in-depth knowledge, but a lot more knowledge than what we would have going into the Hill. And so had I did it all over again, I probably would have tried to, you know, immerse myself more in the knowledge aspect prior to going on the Hill. But it was really like, yo, man, let me jump on this wagon. Let me hang on for dear life, right? And try to figure it out. And I would tell you that I had great teammates too, because Pat was our fearless leader, right? He's the MLA, the military legislative assistant to Senator Bozeman. So essentially, he was Senator Bozeman's right-hand man when it came to defense and veterans stuff, right? And so he was very adamant about like making sure that I got all of the learning that I could out of, you know, out of my time on the Hill. And so he allowed me to be a part of everything, every meeting. Like, I got to do meetings with CEOs, you know, Lockheed, you know, name the industrial based company, right? And I got to meet their top leaders and just be in the room and absorb so much. But I would tell you, man, that it was, I was overwhelmed at the very beginning for sure, because I was like, what did I just get myself into? But you get your footing, right? And you start to figure it out. You start to figure out, all right, here's the pace. Here's what we need to do. It's a very, our hours were 9 to 6, right? So you know that you have that, but then you also have receptions that you have to go to, right? Because you know, it's a relationship game, right? And so I got to get to know the other staffers. I got to get to know the other fellows and the other, you know, from the other branches of service and all of that. So I'm trying to network and learn and so that we can try to get legislation passed and all that good stuff. And so, you know, sometimes it was, you know, long nights. But what I would tell people all the time is like, man, I work harder on the Hill than I did being an MTI, right? And being a drill instructor, man. That was crazy to kind of put that together at the end of my year on the Hill. I was like, man, I worked harder here than I did being a drill instructor. And I was working 10, 12 hours a day, 6 days a week as a drill instructor. So, So trial by fire for sure.
Yeah. Well, so that's kind of what I would throw back to you then is with his, and I'll just say as broken as our education system is, like in the how we put degrees and everything like that on a pedestal and the financial, mm-hmm. you know, student loan debt crisis that we have going on right now, mm-hmm. you're talking about the master's degree, which is, hey, that's awesome. Self-improvement, education, that kind of stuff. I would throw back to you, I think that the education that you got through that sitting in there and that experience is probably more fruitful and more beneficial than what you would have gotten getting that master's.
Oh yeah, for sure. I would agree with that 100%. Like, I don't feel like the master's would have benefited me on the back end, right? Like, I feel like, yes, the experience of being on the Hill was that's really what I needed, right? Mm-hmm. I'm saying from a master's degree perspective, I think that they were more prepared to go on the Hill and understanding the concepts, the background of Congress, how it operated, you know, how it operates and all that stuff like that. So yes, I agree with you 100%. The knowledge and the experience that I gained of being on the Hill, holy crap, man. Like,
yeah,
it's go for it. Yeah, I was just going to say, like some of the, you know, sitting in like CLC, the chief leadership course, right, and hearing how people talk versus like where the Air Force is going, where DOD is going from a strategic level. I'm like, all right, guys, we're kind of missing the point, man. Here's some things that you want to be keyed in on so that you understand, you know, yes, at the squadron level, they're doing this, but here's the reason why they're doing this from a DOD strategic level. So you're 100% right.
100%. Yeah, and that's why that's why that whole CLC portion is important, because we've got to be able to connect the strategic vision to the operational vision, to the tactical vision, all the way down to the squadron and the flights and stuff like that. So, I mean, all that makes sense. I throw it out there because I'm in a world with predominantly officers. And so IDE and SDE, which are school programs for those out there that aren't familiar with it, you know, where you can apply. Not every officer gets picked up, but they can go to, you know, Harvard, Stanford, Princeton, mm-hmm. you know, all these, you know, amazing schools. as part of their development. But one of the arguments is like, okay, well, sure, they can go to this school, but is it actually better for us to send them to, you know, a staff job or something like that, mm-hmm. or a legislative liaison, because their experience will actually give them a better education and better them and better whatever organization they end up going to later on.
Yeah, I agree with that, man. You know, Steve Hart, man, at CLC, the chief leadership course, he had mentioned that too, was like, yo, you know, all of these officers, they're great, right? They're getting all of this education, but what they're missing from on the enlisted side is that the enlisted folks are getting all of this experience of leadership knowledge, right? And they know how to lead people effectively, right? And so knowing how to lead on that level from a strategic perspective, sitting in a staff office and understanding how the industrial base works, how that is connected to DOD and how they are, you know, working acquisitions and their budget and all that stuff like that, right? So that I can bring that back and I can advise commanders on a whole different level simply because of the experience that I had. So yes, I back to your point, right? Like having a master's degree, I don't think outweighs your experience. I think, you know, honestly, your experience outweighs a degree because yeah, I can have the knowledge, I can read the book, right? But at the end of the day, until I put it into practice and I operate on that, it becomes nature. It becomes natural.
You realize that they don't follow the book at all.
Yeah.
That book's BS because they don't follow it, just like we don't follow doctrine.
That's true. That's true.
Easy. Yeah. Well, did you ever see that, Josh, when you're up on the Hill, when people would say like, hey, if we do this here at this level way up here, this is what it will look like down in like the trenches, you know, down in the weeds. And like as a, especially as an enlisted guy, you did the MTI thing. You've been from the ground level all the way up. And like, did you ever see them kind of like miss the mark? You're like, that's not really what that is going to look like once it gets down to the bottom.
Yeah, I think you see consternation, right? Because the message is not trickling back and forth, right? I think that from the strategic level, you have, you know, they have their mindset set on certain things, right? Hey, we got to be focused in on the pacing threat. We got to be focused in on, you know, how are we going to make sure that we restock our stockpiles, right? Like these are the things that they're thinking about. And so they're trying to formulate plans based on that without hearing from the bottom to say, hey, here's what we're struggling with. Here's what we're dealing with. And so you see those repercussions down the line. And I'll give you an example of like MILCON, right? It's the funding for buildings and stuff like that for construction, military construction is what it is, right? MILCON, military construction. And so you see that like with the Army. The Army just came out with, you know, their $10 billion program where they're redoing dorms and stuff like that, spending $1 billion a year, right? Revitalizing their dorms and stuff. But that was because, you know, they got way far behind. You're seeing issues with MILCON and the Air Force, right? And so mm-hmm. The Air Force is trying to, you know, get after those things. And so, yes, I do believe that the messages are not being conveyed back and forth. And so I say also to the other side, right, is that a lot of times the message is trying to be for, you can see it at the Pentagon level, right? Like top leaders are really trying to get the message down to the squadrons, but I think it gets stifled. I haven't found out exactly where it's getting stifled at, but it's getting stifled prior to getting to the squadron levels, right? And allowing the airmen to hear firsthand, here's where we're going, here's why we're doing that. And here's, you know, we need to get feedback from you, right? I think you'll see that in the coming days, right, with a lot of the stuff that's getting ready to be changed from an Air Force perspective. I think it's a lot of great stuff from the great power competition stuff, right? I think it'll be a lot of great momentum, but I think that there's going to be a lot of feedback that's going to be needed to make sure that we have the right adjustments that were made, right, and to realign ourselves correctly to meet our match, right, to meet that pacing threat. So,
well, from where you're at, then, since we're talking about, you know, military construction and MILCON and all that kind of stuff, yes, we have fallen behind as a service, as a DOD, and I think personally, and I have zero data to back this up, I just think that it's because we have been so operationally focused and spending so much money on, you know, training, munitions, things downrange, that we've kind of let other things lapse. And now you're right, we're playing catch up. Like $10 billion for the Army just to do that, that's probably just scratching the surface, considering how many bases the Army has, how many people they have at all those to revamp all those dorms. And with inflation and everything the way that it is, things are just really expensive now. So is that what's kind of being talked about up there in terms of, all right, well, now that we've got to start working on our infrastructure, because if our infrastructure isn't solid or on a good path forward, we can't focus on things downrange operationally.
Yeah, that's a big question.
It is a big question.
Yeah.
That's why you get paid the big bucks.
I think there's a lot that goes into that, right? Like, I think that you have some folks who are concerned about that, right? And I'll speak specifically to Senator Bozeman and his team, because that's really the firsthand knowledge that I got, right? Senator Bozeman is very concerned about the quality of life for the enlisted as a whole, but specifically for him, the Air Force. If you know a little bit of his backstory, he's, you know, his father was in the Air Force, and so he had, and he was an enlisted guy, Master Sergeant, 26 years, right? And so he has a strong passion for the enlisted folks and their quality of life. And so I say that to say that there are folks who are concerned about infrastructure, about making sure that we're taking care of those things. And so one of the things that that they do on the Hill is through Senator Bozeman, he's one of the chairs for the Air Force Caucus on the Senate side. And so every year they put together a plan to send staffers out from across the Senate, right, to go to these different Air Force bases and stuff to see what's going on, right? So last year we did a day in the life of an airman, where we took them to Lackland. So they went to BMT, saw BMT, right? They went to Randolph, right? We went to the Medina Annex and saw some of your gurus down there, right, killing the game. And then we went down we went up to the Air Force Academy. And saw those guys, and we went to Schriever, saw Space Force, and then we went to Nellis, right? But during that time, they were all, you know, very intentional, and we would tell the leadership there, like, hey, I get it, right? We want to show them the warm and fuzzy stuff, everything's hoorah, good, good, but we also, we need them to see what is going wrong, right? So that if we want to make sure that we get the funding that we need, right, these staffers need to see that. And so they did a very good job of showing them the dorms and how bad they were and all that stuff like that. And so to answer your question in a roundabout way, yes, it is being conversated. People are seeing it, and the staffers, I would say, and we were just talking about this before we jumped on the air, right? Staffers, like, let's be honest with ourselves, they run the government, right? Like, these young guys are the ones who are putting policy into play, right, and saying, hey sir, hey ma'am, talking to their representative or their senator and saying, this is the message that we need to push, and as long as that member is on board with it, it's going full force, right? And so allowing those staffers to see those type of things was very helpful and instrumental in getting some milk on. And then, as you, I don't know if you know, but Senator Bozeman, he's the ranking member on the MILCON VA, which is the appropriation side, the budget side, the funding side of getting money to those type of infrastructures, facilities and stuff like that. And so very helpful in the end. But I will say all of that to say this too, you got to understand Congress. You got to understand the dynamics of what members are about, right? And they're not brash. I mean, they're not shy about saying what this is about, right? And it's about their district. It's about their constituents, right? They got to make sure that they're making sure that their constituents are happy, right? And so, you know, the DOD has to be very strategic in how they approach, like, rebasing and, you know, putting new missions and locations and stuff like that. And so all of that plays a part in how funding is brought together. But yes, to answer your question, it is being talked about.
Yeah,
but I don't know if it's on the level that we want it to be.
Of course not. I mean, because we don't have an unlimited budget, and MILCON takes a long time to program it out and all that kind of stuff. I do think it's funny though that, I mean, you didn't necessarily go to terrible bases either though.
But
those mega structures on Lackland that are brand new. I mean, they're, I don't know how old they are, 10 years old maybe.
They're probably getting ready to be torn down. That's how old you are. You think they're brand new. They're about done.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, you're talking about the ATC dorms, the BMT basic doors?
Yeah. Dude, I remember, like, because it had been a long time since I'd been to Lackland, and I went there, I don't know, 5 years ago or something like that, just on a trip. And I'm sitting here looking, as I'm approaching the gate, I see these mega structures. And I'm like, what are these? And it's mind blowing to me how big they are.
Well, I'll tell you, man, that even I learned this, not even when I was a general instructor, but I learned this on my staff deal back to go check it out with the staffers, right? That those dorms were built with all of the HVAC stuff in the roof, right? So, and anytime you need to fix that, you have to literally take off the roof just to go in and fix it. So a lot of those dorms are not even, like, you'll see like a big old HVAC system on the side of the building creating HVAC, or, you know, heating and air, AC for those facilities, because their actual HVAC is broken. It costs too much to actually go in and fix it. So the new ones that they're building, I don't know if y'all remember the bridge to nowhere. I don't know if y'all remember that, where there was nothing on the other side of that bridge. They're actually building complexes over there now, and they're doing it the right way. They're actually putting the HVAC system in a whole building by itself on the ground so that they can get in there and fix it. So
think about that.
Little that's, things like that.
So, like, who designed that? Who thought that was a good idea?
So that's like the things that, you know, that you're trying to get out there. But to your point, yes, that time we went to, they were okay bases and stuff like that, right? I felt like, you know, there were still some things that needed to be fixed. But yes, in the grand scheme of things, Air Force Academy, right? You would think that they're going to put a lot of money into that already, right? But they've done this year after year through the Air Force Caucus. It wasn't just a 1 year thing, right? Like, they've done this multiple years. So they're going to different locations every single time. And they're not only going to just Air Force bases, but they're going to, you know, I know 1 year they went to Marine barracks and all that stuff like that, and talked about COLA, cost of living allowance, and all that stuff like that for the drill instructors, for the Marines, and all that stuff as well too. So it's a year over year thing. But again, right, I don't think it's being talked about on the level that we want it to be talked about, to make sure that the quality of life at home station is still good for our service members. So
it's hard. You know, like, if you've tried to build anything in the last few years, there's been like logistical chain problems, just like building a regular building, right? And everything in the military and the government, it's like you take your simple process that they're struggling with anyway because of like the COVID and all these other things that had happened, and then you make it 10 times more complicated and expensive, and then try to make it happen. Like, it was a weird time in my life when I was in a meeting and someone started talking about like running out of missiles or rockets or whatever we were trying to get our hands on at the time. And to step back and realize, like, this isn't some magical process that just happens. You know, like, we have to buy these things. Things have to be built. Like, the government and the military does not have unlimited resources. And like, you know, like, we get our stuff from somewhere, and they got to build it, and like, they have to get paid and all these other things. It's just insanely complicated.
Yeah. And to your point, right, like, you think about it, even from a missile and bomb perspective, the industrial base, they have to get funded every year. Right. So like, when their budget goes out, right, when they finally pass the appropriations budget, the defense budget, that's what pays that industrial base. Right. So if the bill is not being passed, they're not getting paid. And so it's on an annual basis. And so one of the things that they're looking at is a multi-year procurement opportunity. Right. So where Congress funds them to be able to procure and build missiles and bombs, or procure the Defense Department to be able to procure missiles and bombs over multi-years versus just 1 year at a time.
Yeah,
because it's all based on. It's the funding is all based on war, if we're honest with ourselves, right? So the more war we have, right, the more money the DOD and you know, the industrial base get. But then when there's no war, right, then all of that goes away. And so then what happens with the industrial base? They have to ebb and flow, right? They ebb and flow as far as, you know, manning. They have to lay people off when it's low. You know, they have to hire a bunch of people when it's high, right? And so then they got to learn, you got to train them up and teach them how to, you know, build missiles and bombs quickly. So it's an ebb and flow thing. And so they're starting to realize that they need to fund from a multi-year procurement perspective versus just 1 year at a time, to make sure that those industrial base can stay consistent and making sure that they're getting the funding that they need and get those missiles and bombs where they need to go. But it's the same. Oh, go ahead. It's the same.
When you do that, you don't have to worry about the election season, right? I mean, you know.
Man. That's a valid point.
And that's probably one of the reasons why things for the government cost so much, right? If you can only do things 1 year at a time, it's like, well, I got to charge you this much money because this is a giant pain to do these things every year and to like just be sitting on the fence, like waiting for y'all to get back to me and be like, what's the number this year? You know, like, so like the company's got to take care of themselves. I'm not saying that they're not making obscene profits, you know, maybe ethically or not, but still it's...
But yeah, you're right. I mean, interest rates fluctuate and everything too, right? And so, you know, cost of building supplies and everything ebbs and flows. And so year to year, it's different, right? So.
I had something good that I wanted. Come back to me. Talk about
one of the things
I'll
is like requirements, right? There's one of the last things I want to talk about, like logistical stuff like this, is like we make fun of them putting the AC stuff in the roof. Mm-hmm. But like in a normal building that's occupied like 40 hours a week, maybe, that's probably fine. But like our buildings are occupied, like those BMT buildings are occupied 365, 24/7 by a bunch of people, you know, like that we just shove in there and they're a bunch of mouth breathers. And, you know, like things break a lot faster when the ops tempo for the structure is that high.
Yeah, no, I agree 100%. And so I think that's something that's, on our part from the DOD perspective, right, to make sure that we're hiring the right companies to build our facilities and whatnot. So now
you're moving on. So like what, so there is going to be a new Chief Master Sergeant of the Air Force soon, right? Yep. That's who you're going to.
Yeah. March 8th will be the transition ceremony. Chief Master Sergeant of the Air Force Bass, she'll be retiring. And Chief Master Sergeant Flossie will be the new Chief Master Sergeant of the Air Force. He's coming from the Air Force Material Command.
How long do you think it's going to take him to get his arms around exactly how all of this works?
Oh, my gosh.
Because I almost feel bad for this person, but, like, it'll be kind of fun to watch.
It just depends, right? Like, I don't know. I'll be honest, I'm not too familiar with him. I've talked to other chiefs and stuff like that to kind of get an understanding of who he is. I'm excited to work with him and do the best I can to advise him. I think that with each Chief Master Sergeant of the Air Force, there is a view of what they want to do, and then there's also a view of what the Secretary of the Air Force and the Chief of Staff want them to do, right? And so I think it'll be really based and determined off of that. Like, hey, what does General Alvin want Chief Flossie to be focused in on, right? Like, we know that the normal stuff, personnel, you know, readiness, quality of life issues, you know, those things like that. But how intentional does he want him to be in those when it comes to, you know, going to Congress and stuff like that? But I will tell you that, my team, me and then also, you know, a few other chiefs, we're already working on like, hey, here's the engagement plan for him. Here's, you know, we want to start, put a training session together to kind of teach him how Congress operates, what to be looking out for, you know, some of those things like that. So I think it just depends on him, right, as a person, how quickly he can pick it up. But I think you could tell from like, you know, Chief Bass, I think she picked it up fairly quickly, but then, you know, it was determined on her, like, hey, what are my initiatives? What are my priorities? What do I want to do? And then am I going to really make this happen or not? And I think at the end of her term, I think she really kind of got into her groove this last year. She got into her groove and was really saying, hey, you know, paying compensation. I don't know if you guys watched the hearing that happened on the 31st, but, you know, pay and compensation and BAH were like the big priorities that they wanted to talk about. So
that's some big ass rocks to try and move.
It really is, right?
Like,
and
like that's not some just like, all right, we're good.
Yeah, it is. And that's the frustrating part about this, right? Is that every 4 years a new person comes in. Or maybe even less than that, right? And if there's a message that's trying to be pushed, to Congress and honestly to DOD as well, right? To make sure that, you know, the DOD obviously is a stakeholder in this, right? And we got to get them to be on board. And so, you know, to get them all on the same page of, hey, we want to do pay and compensation. You know, we got to look at the military pay chart. It hasn't been updated in over 20 years, right? You know, things like that, you know, targeted pay raises, you know, or, you know, different opportunities that can be pushed to help when it comes to pay. Those are huge rocks. And if the message is not continuously passed down, I think you see what has been happening in the past, right? Like 20 years since the military pay chart has been adjusted, right? I mean, you see the pay disparity between officer and enlisted, right? I mean, and it continues to widen simply because of the offset of the percentage that's given every year, right? So 5.2% pay raise this year, right? Guess what? 5.2% pay raise to an airman that's getting $2,000 is a lot less than for an officer who's getting paid, you know, $10,000. Yeah. You know, so it continues to widen. And so those things is what Chief Bass was trying to get after, right? And some of the other SEAs from the different services as well. But that message has to be continued, right? So Chief Flossie has to pick that message up and run with it. And so,
that disparity continues to grow while the actual, you know, duties, education, impact in the real world, that gap closes. Because it used to be that enlisted swine were uneducated, untrustworthy, and bear considerable watching. But I mean, yeah, we still need to be watched quite a bit. But
yeah.
I mean,
and I understand.
I'm not saying we don't need to be, but you know.
And I understand the difference between, you know, authority and responsibility. I understand that officers have the authority, right? And the enlisted have the responsibility, and that authority that the officers have, they invest that, you know, give us the parameters of our responsibility. So I understand. I would never take away from an officer and, you know, the fact that, hey, you went that route and, you know, you have the authority to make decisions and you can, I mean, yes, we can be fired too, but yeah, yours looks a lot worse, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, I give them that, right? And so I do believe, like, yes, officers should, you know, continuously be paid more than we do. But I think that there's got to be an adjustment based on, you know, the type of individual that we're bringing in on the enlisted side, to your point, right? People are coming in with master's degrees, you know, bachelor's degrees. And, you know, some, I mean, we had airmen coming in with doctorates, right? And so to they're shortening that disparity when it comes to education and experience. And we need to do the same when it comes to pay compensation. And then, yeah, as you look in the civilian sector, right? Like, some of the benefits that we're you know, raving about, oh yeah, well, we give you free education and, you know, we'll, you know, do this and do that for you. Well, the reality is that Papa John's does that for you now, right? You can work at Papa John's and they'll pay for your degree. You can work at Starbucks and they'll pay.
I didn't
for, you can
know
work
that
at
all.
You can work at Target and
about to go
and
submit an application to Papa John's right now.
You know what I mean? Like, just little things like that. And so we got to look at different ways of incentivizing our recruiting effort, right? And so I think, man, I'm a services guy through and through, man. Like, I love the military. I love what I do. I love putting on the uniform. And I love, you know, my country, man. But I think in this day and age with our younger generation, yes, that is a part of it. But I think that there's got to be more to it. There's got to be more in it for them, if that makes sense. So
no, I agree. And that, so I want to take a quick step back just because of who you were working for Senator Bozeman, but identifying, or is he addressing at all the kind of, since we're talking about disparities, there is a lot of companies out there, especially within the military industrial complex. You know, I won't name any, you know, the big ones, right? That we all know. When I retire or I separate and go apply for a job, they look at my resume and they look and they go, oh, okay, you were enlisted, retired at E whatever. While the other person that I'm interviewing with retired at an 05 or an 06. And they'll go, okay, well, you guys are coming for the same job. You're actually going to do the same exact job. Well, he's a retired 06, so we're going to pay him appropriately. You were retired as an E9. We're going to pay you appropriately, which is actually less. Have you seen that? Are you aware of that? Two is Senator Bozeman trying to get after that?
Yeah, I'm not aware of that. And that wasn't ever a conversation while I was in the office either. So, man, that's new to me. I've not heard that. I didn't know that was happening.
That is a thing.
Where they looked at whether you were an officer and enlisted, and they're going to, so there's a pay disparity within the civilian sector being hired on the outside. So no, I had not heard that.
Yeah. Part of that is because a lot of those folks are retired military. So they are still, and they're old, like they're just old. So they don't know what the actual military looks like now and the difference and the blurring of lines of jobs and duties and, authorities and stuff like that. So they are still stuck in a very, you know, old mindset. And that's actually one of the things that SEAC Troxel is trying to get after, in his afterlife of serving, is he's still trying to change a lot of that stuff. So are a lot of the other, senior enlisted folks that separated that are, you know, now working for a lot of these companies or advising a lot of these companies as they're trying to get after that. And then I don't want to say that it's very prolific in all these folks, but I mean, the reason why I know it is because I've had friends that have retired and they're like, dude, you will not believe this shit.
Wow. That's crazy. I did not know that at all. Mm-hmm. That's crazy. Wow.
Yeah.
Not to take a negative
Everybody should
turn.
Just be enlisted first. We could solve this problem. Everybody should come in enlisted first.
Exactly.
Get rid of the degree stuff. Shut down the schools that are taxpayer funded for no good reason. And then at your 4 or 6 year mark, you can apply to become an officer or whatever.
I wanted to see where you're going with this.
That's it. I'm not saying that the Air Force Academy is a giant waste of money, but.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not too keen on this, like too in the weeds on it. But I know Australia, like they do it, like they pay you based off of your responsibility, right? So you can be enlisted or officer, but they're going to pay you on the level of responsibility that they give you. And so, I mean, I could see a military like that, right? Where, you know, because I'm a, you know, command chief at the MAGCOM level, I should be getting paid this much because.
Way less money than the squadron chief.
But your scope of responsibility is enormous at a MAGCOM level.
Yeah,
or
exactly.
Or a combatant command level or something like that.
Correct. Yeah. So I know I could see that in the future, right? Like, paying compensation changing to that level where we pay based off of level of responsibility versus, you're just a E3 or whatever. You know what I mean? So.
I can get on board with that.
So I do want to talk about one thing real quick for people out there. This may not be interesting to you, but when people talk about colors of money and funding streams from the government, like when we talk about like, hey, we need to like add more money over here. I think it's easy for a civilian to like, or anybody to look at like the giant DOD budget and be like, how can you not afford this? And not understand that all that is parsed out and colored in different colors and moving money from like one pot to another pot is so incredibly difficult and frustrating to like move things around and to make changes. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. I mean, so I haven't really seen it from the military side, but I did see it from the congressional side. So there's two different sides to it, right? It is incredibly difficult, right? I can't just take, you know, F-35 money and put it over to quality of life money. It just doesn't work that way, right? Because Congress has a lot to say in how you spend your money. And so when Congress hits stamp approve, we're giving you this money, it ain't going nowhere but to whatever they tell you it's going to, right? And so so it's incredibly hard to be able to just, you know, move money from one thing to the next. So from a congressional standpoint, right. So, you know, it could be like, hey, we're putting money towards the F-35 mission for, you know, FMS, Foreign Military Sales. Right. And that money has to stay going there. Once it's stamped approved, it has to stay going there. Or MILCON, right? That's why they have the different committees in Congress, right? So you have the MILCON VA committee. That's the Appropriations Committee, specifically for funding infrastructures and everything like that. So all of that funding funnels through that committee. They kind of, within that committee, they stamp approval on it. Then it goes up to the big Appropriations Committee, the Defense Committee, right? The Defense Committee is a bigger committee of senators, and they all stamp approval on that, right? And then it goes, you know, to the overall appropriations, and then all the senators that are on appropriations, they all got to stamp approval on that, right? And so, so there is a huge process that is played out, right? It's a lot. I mean, it can be fast, but a lot of times anything in Congress is probably going to go slow because there's got to be some, you know, there's got to be some compromise, right? And so, but each of those fundings, right, has to, once it's stamped approved by Congress, it's going to that particular thing, and that's it. Like, you're not changing that, right? Now, you can take, like the approval for the appropriations for the 5.2% pay increase has not, honestly, it hasn't been passed, right? Like, it was authorized in the NDAA, but it has not been stamped approved by appropriations, which is actually what gives you the funding for that. And so right now, what the military is doing, what DOD is doing, is they're taking from a pot of money for personnel, right? You know, and putting it towards that until they get the funding for the 5.2% pay increase. So through the appropriations budget. I hope that makes sense. I try not to make it too complex, but to answer your question quickly, no, it is hard to pass money from, you know, from infrastructure to, you know, personnel, or from, you know, F-35 stuff to, you know, infrastructure stuff. It's just not going to happen. So
you know the Always Sunny in Philadelphia meme where Charlie is like in front of the board with all the strings going in all the different directions?
And
me trying to switch. There's going to be one of those, like, Chief Leonard explains, you know, DOD funding. And it's just like strings everywhere.
Yeah, it's just atrocious.
But it's not easy, and it's very confusing, which is why, that's why, you know, from an outsider's perspective, when you're looking at it and you're being critical of it, which we should be critical of it because it's our money, you know, you're like, you get frustrated because you're like, I don't understand why this is so difficult and why these things are lacking, you know. And you get a lot of people that are, why are the dorms in, you know, in the Army or the Marines or whatever, and even some Air Force bases, why are they bad?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. And then the other aspect to it too, right, is really if you did that, right, if you said, all right, well, let's move some of this money over here, you're just really robbing Peter to pay Paul, right? Because mm-hmm. if you're going to take that money and put it somewhere else, then that mission is going to lag. You know what I mean? And so the truth is that you want to do your best to provide Congress with everything that you need so that they give you the funding that you need.
It's not as easy as just saying, well, let's just do one less F-35. Correct. Let's take that money and move it over here for the dorms. It's not, you can't do that. In fact, I think legally you can't do that.
And so, you can get real technical with it down to the J books, right? And looking at program elements, line items of, all right, this specific amount of money is going to this particular thing, right? And so you can get real technical with it and say, all right, I definitely can't move this money because they've already programmed it for this particular, you know, whatever it is.
That's for the Air Force Band. That's where that money's going.
What a hater.
That's all I'm saying. I didn't even say anything negative about it. Man, I just said that's where the money's going.
Don't knock those guys that play the flute, man. They're good. You know what I'm saying?
every job matters.
You know what I'm saying?
Couldn't even say with a straight face. Every job matters.
So how long are you going to be the like financial advisor liaison person to the SIMSAF and all those other folks?
So it'll be at least another year. I'm projected to be here until June of 25, but I can leave anywhere if my two-star proves it. And I can leave anywhere between January 25 to June of 25. So, but it'll just be kind of depending on, I want to make sure that there's a good transition and make sure that whoever's replacing me is going to be, you know, up to the task and we're solid in that role before leaving. So this is a new role for the enlisted. So it's actually really cool within FML. Because last year was the first year that we had an enlisted guy in there. And so he's getting ready to transition out. I'm taking over for him. And so we're really kind of building this role up because they had SIMSAF and SIMCIF. SIMCIF is the Chief Master Sergeant of the Space Force. They had advisors on the authorizing side. So that's all of the like policy stuff, you know, authorizing funding. But they never had an advisor from the appropriation side saying, hey, these are the people that you need to talk to because they're going to actually fund what we're authorized, what the other like, senators.
That's a great plan.
Authorized.
You know, no one's funding that, right?
So yeah, like, yeah, exactly.
Good job wasting all your time.
Yeah. So now having that, having us here, I think is going to be very beneficial to our enlisted corps, and to be able to get after some things, from a funding perspective. So hopefully within the next 3 to 5 years, you guys will see some pretty cool things coming out, that the senior enlisted advisors to our service, to the DAF are really, putting into play. So that's my hope.
Yeah, I'm excited to see what SIMSAF Flossie is able to do. Is the SIMCIF also swapping out?
He just recently swapped out. Okay. It was Chief Toberman, and they swapped out in September timeframe. Now it's Chief Bentivenia. They call him B9 because he has 9 letters in his last name.
I was wondering. I saw some email traffic about a B9, and I was like, I don't know who this is.
Is that an aircraft?
Yeah,
that's what comes in red meat, right? That's
So he just recently swapped out, and so yeah, we're working with him to do his 90-day engagement plan on Capitol Hill, man, and really kind of get some things rolling for the Space Force. So
yeah, well, that's good because they need it. Not to throw shade at them, but they definitely need it really bad. And the reason why I'm saying that is because you have the Space Force they were created and I'll say kind of hastily created, and they've got an extremely important mission, but they don't know how to, for their enlisted corps, their officer corps, and then, you know, there's a lot of contractors, a lot of civilians, because of all the technical expertise that are required. Mm-hmm. And their enlisted force is actually struggling right now to find their role as enlisted. Their officer force is struggling because they're trying to find their role as officers, and there's a lot of blending right there for them. So some insider baseball on that, but they're learning their way right now, but they're a young force, you know. No comments.
I think we might have.
No, somebody's trying to call me on my phone. I'm trying to turn my phone off.
Dude, what's going on? Dude, how freaking rude.
Listen up, Senator. I'm on a podcast right now. Yeah. There's like 6 people going to see this.
Yeah.
It's very important.
SIMSAF, chill out. All right.
No, so yeah, I agree with you, right? And I think you'll see that with the tech tracks that they're coming out with. They're talking about bringing in warrant officers into the cyber and like the tech world of Space Force, right? So that, you know, and we talked about this too a little bit in the Chief Leadership course about tech tracks, right? And, you know, hey, how do we want this to look from an enlisted perspective? Do we think warrant officers are needed in the Air Force and the Space Force? What career fields do warrant officers need to be in? And so, but I think you'll see some of that in the Space Force in the near future, where you'll have warrant officers in cyber and stuff like that, where they're just specifically focused on you know, the job. They don't need to be worried about leadership or anything like that. And I think that that's, to me, I think that that's huge, right? Because you got airmen right now that don't want to be leaders. They don't want nothing to do with, you know, oh, I got to supervise 5 people. I got to supervise 20 people. Like, what are you talking about? I just want to do my job, you know? And so, and I think that's going to be advantageous if we take to that and say, hey, let's create a tech route where you're a technical expert, you know your job, you can still promote through that, but you're not going to be, you're not going to have to take on the leadership supervisory roles. Now, granted, right, the more, again, this is why I think that we can move to a route of you get paid based on your responsibility, because I think, you know, if I'm going to go the route of taking on that leadership role, right, and having to lead other people and making sure that I have that scope of responsibility, I think those individuals should get paid more, right? Because they're taking on more than what a tech route would be. So but I think you'll, yeah. I think you'll see that though. I think you'll see that.
It'll be interesting to see if they go warrants, it's going to be tough for the Air Force to say no warrants.
That's true. I think it'll be based on, it'll be just career field based though, right? Like it's not going to be like warrant officers across the board. It'll be like career field specific. These career fields will get warrant officers. You know what I mean? So.
Yep.
Well, for a lot of those career fields, what we have instead of warrant officers are contractors. And how many times do those senior airmen pop smoke and come back the next day, get paid more money, and don't have to supervise anybody just to do the job? And it's not necessarily, I think, that all those senior airmen are loving to get rid of the uniform, but they're like, this is what I want to do. I want to do this job. And the only way to do that is to show up tomorrow in civilian clothes, get paid twice the amount. And like, you're going to pay me more to not take on all this additional responsibility. That's wild. Absolutely. Yep. So
the only alibi of that is you don't get to go deploy and actually, you know, do it. That's the only downside.
Which is like a huge positive for you. Like I understand that, but like I think for these cyber nerds, where are they deploying to, you know?
To the cyber gurus, man, they're going nowhere. They're staying right there. They're deployed in garrison, right? And so to your point, so then, you know, we're doing a disservice to ourselves. We're killing ourselves in that aspect, right? Because if we're saying that you can get out and get paid more as a civilian doing the same exact job, we'll pay you more as a civilian. Like we're shooting ourselves in the foot at that point. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you can get some special warfare warrant officers out there to plug the cyber folks into whatever they want to plug into, wherever it is, you know. So like they're good. It's all gonna work out. Everybody gets warrants, and then we solve all the world's problems.
No.
Okay. All right. Josh, what was the biggest surprise over the last year of things that you saw or something that you had to learn that you just didn't expect that you were going to have to do?
I would say the biggest surprise is how funding works from a congressional perspective, in the sense of like what opportunities senators have. And what I mean by that is that when we're doing the budget, right, there are times where the member can actually request funding for specific things within their district, right, that go in line with whatever it is. So, you know, for MILCON or whatever, or defense budget or whatever. If you're on appropriations, you get what is called CDS, and that's congressional directed spending. So then that means whatever, and that was why the FRA last year, the Fiscal Responsibility Act last year that they implemented was like a lot of members didn't like that because that put a top line on what they could spend, right? Because normally what happens is you see the budget roll out, right? And then once Congress is all done with it, it's more times than not, it's increased, right? And the reason why is because they have this opportunity to do congressional directed spending, right? So essentially you put out a list on there and say, hey, you know, for my district, we're doing X, Y, and Z for defense. So I need this many things, you know, for my district or my state or whatever. And so they'll normally, you normally put on there, you know, 40 different things. Now, again, it goes to the committee and the committee has to approve it. So normally it just depends. You're not going to get your whole list, right? But you may get your top 10, top 15, whatever, right? And then that money is applied to the top line of the budget, right? And so Seeing that, I was like, oh, wow. So like there was a lot of things that are done through universities, like a lot of industrial based type stuff, a lot of what is it called, like technology type stuff, like AI type stuff that are done, that's done like research and stuff like that, R&D, right? Research and development that's done through universities that funding can go to. So it was really cool to kind of see how all that has played out. But again, right, like it was based on a member state. So that's why it's so key that a state has, you know, appropriators that are senators or reps or whatever, because they get money for their state in that regard. So so that was pretty cool to see. That was a big surprise. I didn't realize that. I thought it was like, hey, you know, the president budget comes through, we kind of, you know, take a whack at it or whatever. And, you know, all right, no, we're really not going to spend money there. We're going to spend it here. I didn't realize how much power, you know, these senators, the appropriation senators have in putting money, directing money to their state. Yeah, I was like, wow, that's actually really cool. So.
It is crazy.
Yeah, you hold the purse strings, you got all the power, right? Because you got all the yes and no's, and yeah, nothing happens without the money. Well, dude, I want to thank you for coming back on. I was super excited about it. Good to see you again. And always, we have to end with, obviously, we're talking to folks that are looking to getting into special warfare, and we didn't really talk about any of that today necessarily, but like this is like the inner upper workings of the entire, you know, DOD and where it meets the congressional people and how that all works or doesn't work sometimes. But Josh, we always have to ask advice for the folks looking to come in the Air Force, special warfare, anything. You know, like you've had like all these unique opportunities, obviously. So any advice you can give these people that are thinking about joining?
Yeah, man. So I would say one thing is that you go into the special warfare community, y'all are special people, man. Like even Congress looks at y'all as special people. They're like, oh yeah, we'll give them whatever they need, man. Whatever funding they want. They got their own pile of money. They do their thing. I'm like, oh man, okay, cool.
yeah, we're special, all right.
You guys get all the cool toys and all that stuff. I'm like, man, like this is really cool, man. But the advice that I would give, man, is you know, don't be afraid, right? Like, well, I take that back. You're going to be afraid, right? It is what it is, right? Especially if you're going into a special warfare community, right? You're going to be scared. You're going to be nervous. It's okay to be nervous. It's okay to be scared. But allow your courage to overtake that scaredness, right? To overtake that nervousness, right? Allow your boldness, your confidence to overtake that and push you into that next level, man. We need great individuals in our military, whether it's special warfare, whether it's, you know, a services guru like myself, man, that does fitness, food, and lodging. You know, we need everybody, you know what I mean? And so it seems scary at the onset, at the beginning, but I promise you, if you allow your courage and your boldness to propel you, you'll be great, man. And so if I'd leave you with anything, man, let your courage push you. So
that's yeah, amazing. Thank you so much. Thanks for coming back on. Everybody check out onesready.com to see all of our stuff. And Josh, Chief Leonard, excuse me.
No, you're good, brother.
Thanks for coming
on. You're my brother, man. Love y'all. Thank y'all so much for having me, man.
Of course. Man.
Everybody out there, train hard, and we'll catch you next time. Later.
Later.